It's clear that the NRA has been failing to carry out its stated mission for many, many years, and instead has operated as a breeding ground for greed, abuse, and brazen illegality.
Now, are you sure you're talking about the NRA there, Tish James, and not the Republican Party? Kind of sounds the same.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Not much of a difference.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Okay.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle, Washington on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Desi Doyen, you agree I'm a swell fellow,
correct? Of course I do.
Okay, thank
Most
you.
Most of the
I just
time,
wanted to,
yes.
I know, but you know, I'd like you to nod or something when I say that, even though they can't see it on the radio.
I know.
Just so I know. That would help me start the day. All right, so, well, guess what? We have this in late today. Three men face federal firearm charges in connection to the Kansas City Chiefs Super Bowl parade that left one person dead and 22 others injured. One 22-year-old was charged in a 12-count criminal complaint unsealed on Wednesday as filed by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Missouri. Two others, a 21-year-old and a 19-year-old, were charged in a 4-count federal criminal complaint. But these defendants are not actually accused of being the ones to open fire on February 14 in downtown Kansas City, where the Chiefs parade had ended and the rally was held. Two juveniles were arrested by police and charged last month in a Jackson County court on gun-related and resisting arrest offenses. Federal authorities instead said those charged on Wednesday were involved in illegal firearms trafficking and straw purchases of firearms. Yes, apparently we still have laws against that sort of thing, if you can imagine, even in Missouri. So guns have become so ubiquitous in America and certainly in states like Missouri that it's remarkable anyone is ever held to account for those laws, to be frank. And of course, when it does happen, it's usually only after tragedy has struck. Don't believe me? According to court documents in this case, at least 12 people brandished firearms that day. And at least six people fired their weapons during the shooting. No wonder they're having trouble figuring out who actually done it.
Wow, no kidding. And it's amazing more people weren't killed.
Guns, it seems, are everywhere. And despite the hue and cry from the vast majorities of Americans, I should add bipartisan majorities, any and all attempts, it seems, to make it more difficult to purchase such weapons, even in the smallest way, are blocked by lawmakers, largely Republican lawmakers. And for that, we can thank, at least in no small part, the oldest gun lobbying group in the nation, known as the NRA, the National Rifle Association. On that score today, we can report that the group is definitely up against it after the collapse of their leadership, beginning with longtime NRA chief Wayne LaPierre, who was recently found liable for millions of dollars that he pocketed from the group. That thanks to a New York State lawsuit by the state attorney general there, Tish James. But will any of that reverse the years-long imbalance between policies that bipartisan majorities of Americans desperately want in the face of our never-ending gun violence epidemic and the seemingly iron grip influence that the NRA has had on the Republican Party for years to assure that any and all such efforts at gun safety reforms are blocked by GOP lawmakers? At this point, it's unclear if even a ban on devices that turn semi-automatic weapons into machine guns will be allowed to stand by our corrupted right-wing U.S. Supreme Court. We will be joined momentarily by someone from the nation's oldest gun safety organization. That would be the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. To discuss all of this and more, what happens next for the NRA and what happens next in these United States when it comes to our own attempts at gun laws. In the meantime, voters went to the polls or sent ballots in for primaries and caucuses on Tuesday in Georgia, Mississippi, Washington State, and Hawaii. And both President Joe Biden and Donald Trump each won all of the nominating contests to, on the same day, win the number of delegates needed in their respective parties to all but clinch officially their nominations at the RNC and DNC conventions this summer. I'll get to the numbers for what they're worth momentarily, but while I'm happy to note that there have been few reported problems for voters at the polls, at least on Tuesday, there was this out of, yes, the great state of Georgia. Warnings of a, quote, unexpected IT outage.
Oh, dear.
On Tuesday, on the election website of Georgia's most populous county, prompted alarm on social media about potential problems with the state's presidential primary. A red banner atop county web pages warning of a, quote, system outage was actually related to a January cyber attack that temporarily crippled government services in Fulton County, which includes Atlanta. It did not indicate any problems with Tuesday's voting, according to officials. Some users on Twitter, however, questioned whether the warning banner indicated a, quote, glitch or primary election, quote, cheating. Others wondered if it indicated problems at the polls, given that all voters at the polls in Georgia are still forced to use 100% unverifiable computer touchscreen voting systems to simply fill out their ballot, despite the fact that those machines, as a recent trial attempting to bar their use has shown, have vulnerabilities that can be exploited with little more than a ballpoint pen at the polling place. But the warning banner about the unexpected IT outage had, in fact, been posted on county webpages since well before the final day of primary voting. Again, going back to January, Fulton County removed the warning banner from its website on Tuesday, including from the elections page, after the concerns raised on social media. Yeah, you think? Fulton County spokesperson Jessica Corbett said in an email to AP that although the alert had been in place since the end of January, we learned today that it was causing possible confusion for voters, adding that Fulton County is committed to ensuring that our voters have access to accurate and timely information and will always try to prevent and address misinformation. Election officials in Georgia, particularly in Fulton County, are, of course, sensitive to questions like this, questions about the voting process. Donald Trump disputed his loss to Joe Biden in 2020 in Fulton County and elsewhere around the state. He now faces criminal charges with 18 others for attempting to hoax state officials into stealing the election on his behalf. We'll have a little bit more on that in a second. Fulton County previously told the AP there was no indication that election systems were targeted in the cyber attacks earlier this year, but that Fulton County and the Secretary of State's technology systems were isolated from one another as a precaution to suggest they weren't previously,
Guess. That's terrible.
Other than the confusion caused by the warning banner, the Georgia Secretary of State's office said it had seen only minor issues during Tuesday's voting, though that office tends to lie about just about everything. So we'll take it with a grain of salt. As to the results, for what they may be worth in a 100% unverifiable state like Georgia, Donald Trump won reportedly 84.5% of the votes from Republican voters, and Joe Biden walked away with more than 95% of the vote from Democrats. In Mississippi, Trump won a healthier nearly 93% share of the GOP vote, though Joe Biden won 100% on the Democratic side because he faced no actual challenger on that state's ballot on Tuesday. In Washington state, where they largely vote with hand-marked paper ballots by mail, so results come in quickly at first and then slower as they wait for ballots sent before the election to arrive after Election Day. So we've only got about 80% of the vote in as we go to air. Trump so far reportedly carried just 74% of his party's vote in the state. Womp womp. While Joe Biden took almost 87% of the Democratic vote, even with second place going once again to uncommitted in Washington state with about 7.5% of the tally there. In Hawaii's caucuses, Trump arguably had his best showing of the night with 97% of the vote, as Biden picked up only 66%. In Hawaii, at the caucuses, 29% went to uncommitted. Now, there was no such option on the Republican side in any of the contests on Tuesday. But it suggests there's still a fairly robust movement among Democrats to register protest votes, likely related to the administration's policies in Israel. Though, to be fair here, like the caucus that some guy named Jason Palmer actually won outright on the Democratic side in American Samoa last week on Super Tuesday, turnout for the caucuses in Hawaii was pretty low, with just about 1,500 votes cast in total across the state in those Democratic caucuses. So that protest vote amounted to just under 500 votes in total, but still 29%. With both men now their party's presumptive nominees for 2024, the primary and caucus season continues nonetheless, sometimes with other races on the ballot as well as the presidential race, and as a good opportunity for voters in those states to make sure they're properly registered for this year's critical November elections.
Yes, true. And it's a good time to check out whether or not the system works for you.
Yep. Later this week, there will be GOP caucuses on Friday, March 15 in the Northern Mariana U.S. Territory, in Guam on Saturday. And then next Tuesday, March 19, primary elections will be held in a bunch of large states. So, again, a chance to make sure you're properly registered and that you know how and where to vote in those states. In Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, and the great state of Ohio, they will all be primaries, though there will be a Democratic primary. There will not be a Democratic primary in Florida because there's only one candidate in Florida that on the Democratic side. That would be Joe Biden. And under Sunshine State laws, if there's only one candidate in a race, no election for that office is actually held. In other news out of the great state of Georgia today, as promised, and yes, specifically out of Fulton County, the judge overseeing the election interference case against President Donald Trump, former President Donald Trump, and several of his allies, dismissed six counts in the sweeping 41-count criminal racketeering indictment, ruling that the six charges lacked specific detail, but he also declined to dismiss the entire case, the case itself, as Trump and his fellow defendants had hoped. In a 9-page order issued Wednesday morning, Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee appointed by Republican Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp, for what it's worth, dismissed six of the 41 felony counts, alleging that Trump and five of his co-defendants had illegally urged elected officials in Georgia to violate their oaths of office, in their attempts to overturn Trump's 2020 election loss in the state. Quote, as written, these six counts contain all the essential elements of the crimes, but fail to allege sufficient detail regarding the nature of their commission, i.e. the underlying felony solicited. That, according to Judge McAfee, the judge added, this does not mean the entire indictment is dismissed. Prosecutors with Fulton County DA Fonnie Willis's office will be able to refile those charges that McAfee dismissed, but that could take some time. The ruling, nevertheless, comes as a blow for prosecutors who, if they wish to refile those charges, they'll have to take the time to do it. It could take weeks. It could take months, including presenting evidence all over again to another grand jury, etc. So what happened here? Well, Judge McAfee found that the charges related to Trump and five others, I think, asking state officials to violate their oath of office, it lacked enough detail in the indictment. In particular, McAfee ruled that prosecutors failed to specify what part of the federal constitutional oath and or the Georgia constitutional oath that Trump was supposed to have been asking officials to violate. So the judge noted, quote, the defendants could have violated the constitutions and thus the statute in dozens, if not hundreds, of distinct ways. But apparently they forgot to spell that out in the indictment. The six counts that McAfee dismissed undermine key portions of the indictment, including a charge related to Trump's infamous January 2021 call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. You remember the one, asking him, and actually threatening him, in fact, to find just enough votes to hand the election to Trump. So the charge related to that is the one that was thrown out because, though Fonnie Willis charges that Trump was asking the Secretary of State to violate his oath to the Constitution, she didn't actually point out which part of that oath.
So she wasn't specific enough.
Correct. She was specific enough on what was unlawful about what Trump did, asking an official to violate their oath, but she didn't spell out which part of the oath specifically they were being asked to violate.
Wow.
So as a result of that call, Trump was charged with having, quote, unlawfully solicited, requested, and importuned Raffensperger to violate his oath. But McAfee found that the state failed to say which part of Raffensperger's oath or constitutional obligations that Trump was asking him to violate. If and when prosecutors refile the charges, they will have to specify what was solicited in violation of the oath. Got it? McAfee wrote, quote, this court finds that the incorporation of the United States in Georgia constitutions is so generic as to compel dismissal of the six counts. Now, he did leave an additional 35 felony counts in place. Willis's position overseeing the prosecution in the meantime also remains in severe jeopardy right now. Trump defendant Mike Roman, co-defendant, co-conspirator Mike Roman, moved to disqualify Willis entirely in January, alleging that she improperly was benefiting from the prosecution after she took lavish vacations with an attorney that she hired to prosecute the case. That led to a damaging multi-day hearing on Willis's relationship with the attorney, examining whether she reaped benefits from his payments for taking the case and other questions of whether she and the attorney that she hired, Nathan Wade, misled the judge as part of their defense. McAfee has said he will announce by Friday whether Willis should be removed from the case. If she is removed, so is the entire Fulton County prosecutor's office. It then the case doesn't then go away. It would then go to a state prosecutor who could then, as I understand it, reassign it to a different county DA's office and or could make the entire case go away. Or that DA, that other DA's office, whichever one happens it happens to be, may or may not decide they wish to proceed with the case. They may not wish to proceed with the same alacrity that Fani Willis has been trying to move it forward. So we'll see. A lot rests on that ruling by Judge McAfee on Friday, even though experts have looked at this and said there's no reason to believe she should be removed from the case.
Yes, several attorneys have said that the case made by the Team Trump people has not met the threshold of evidence required, specifically under Georgia state law, which is very specific about what you have to prove.
Well, the question is this a the appearance of a conflict of interest, or is it a conflict of interest? Now, the state has been arguing that to be removed, they have to show a clear conflict of interest, not just the appearance of a conflict of interest. So
right.
We'll see where Judge McAfee falls on that. In the meantime, this sort of 2-month drama has now threatened the scheduled August trial date for that case. And with Wednesday's ruling, now it perhaps adds even more delays. Well, nobody said that bringing accountability to the once most powerful man in the world with seemingly endless resources to fight that accountability, nobody ever said that was going to be easy. And now, with Trump's federal criminal trials also being delayed by judges at the U.S. Supreme Court and at the U.S. District Court level down in Florida. Well, looks like it'll be up to the courts in New York to keep the accountability coming, with Trump's felony hush money trial still set to begin at the end of March. That after the state attorney general there, Letitia James, recently secured a $454 million fraud ruling against Trump and his company and several of his top executives, and late last month, a verdict against the previously untouchable National Rifle Association. We will discuss what that ruling means for the once powerful lobbying group after a quick break here with the Brady Center's Kelly Sampson. That's straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Scary. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. While the Fulton County, Georgia district attorney continues to stumble over roadblocks toward criminal accountability for Donald Trump and his band of merry conspirators who tried to steal the state's 2020 election, prosecutors at the state level in New York continue to move ahead in their efforts to bring both civil and criminal accountability to the disgraced former president. Donald Trump's New York State criminal trial on 34 felony charges related to fraudulent transactions meant to hide his 2016 hush money payments to a porn star to help him cheat to win the 2016 presidential election is still on track to begin jury selection on March 25, despite so far futile attempts by Trump attorneys to sidetrack the proceedings with similar procedural objections that have helped to delay Trump's criminal trials at the federal level and indeed down in Georgia. New York State Attorney General Letitia James, at the civil level, as you know, has had tremendous success to date after recently notching what amounts to a nearly $500 million penalty for years of bank, tax, and insurance fraud against Donald Trump, his company, and his top executives, including his two eldest sons. That success by the New York AG comes on the heels of her office similarly taking down, in fact, putting out of business entirely, Trump's fake charity and Trump's phony so-called university. But those are hardly the only huge legal wins for Tish James in New York, who, in addition to taking on the once and perhaps future most powerful man in the world, has also not flinched from taking on one of the nation's most powerful political lobbying organizations, which we have long reported on as the wildly corrupt and, yes, terrorist-supporting NRA. That, even as the body count of those killed by what are essentially weapons of war, semi-automatic weapons, and indeed, as discussed recently at the U.S. Supreme Court, what amount to fully automatic machine gun-style weapons, continues to tragically climb each and every day in the United States. But while much of the nation has been transfixed, perhaps justifiably, for the quest for accountability for the former president, James has been almost sort of quietly piling up wins against the once wildly powerful National Rifle Association and its longtime, wildly corrupt, and now former leader, Wayne LaPierre. As reported by AP late last month, the longtime head of the National Rifle Association misspent millions of dollars of the organization's money using the funds to pay for an extravagant lifestyle that included exotic getaways and trips on private planes and super yachts. That, according to a New York jury at the end of February. The jury found the 74-year-old LaPierre, who announced his resignation from the NRA on the eve of the trial, must now repay in total some $5.4 million to the powerful gun rights group that he led for three decades, while the NRA's retired finance chief, Wilson Phillips, owes $2 million. Jurors also found that the NRA itself failed to properly manage its assets, omitted or misrepresented information in its tax filings, and violated whistleblower protections under New York law. During the trial, evidence was presented that LaPierre billed the supposedly nonprofit NRA more than $11 million for private jet flights, spent more than $500,000 on eight trips to the Bahamas over just a three-year span. He authorized $135 million in NRA contracts for a vendor whose owners showered him with free trips to Bahamas, Greece, Dubai, India, as well as access to a 108-foot yacht. On the stand, LaPierre claimed he hadn't realized the travel tickets, hotel stays, meals, yacht access, and other luxury perks counted as gifts, but he conceded that he had wrongly expensed private flights for his family and accepted vacations from vendors doing business with the NRA without disclosing them. The New York Attorney General, Letitia James, who campaigned on investigating the NRA's not-for-profit status, declared the verdict a, quote, major victory. In New York, she wrote on Twitter, "You cannot get away with corruption and greed, no matter how powerful or influential you think you may be. Everyone," she said, "even the NRA and Wayne LaPierre must play by the same rules." The group, which has in recent years been beset by financial troubles and dwindling membership, was portrayed in the case both as a defendant that lacked internal controls to prevent misspending and as a victim of that same misconduct. In a statement, the NRA highlighted just part of the jury verdict, however, to argue that it was, quote, victimized by certain former vendors and, quote, insiders who abused the trust placed in them. But the jury found that the NRA itself had violated state laws protecting whistleblowers who raised concerns about the organization years ago. after reporting a $36 million deficit in 2018, fueled largely by misspending. The NRA cut back on longstanding programs that had been core to its mission, including training and education, recreational shooting, and law enforcement initiatives. In 2021, it filed for bankruptcy and sought to incorporate in Texas instead of New York, but a judge rejected that move, saying it was an attempt to duck James's lawsuit. Her office said that it now wants an independent monitor to be appointed to oversee the NRA's administration of charitable assets. It also is, it's difficult to even think of this group as a charitable group. In any event, it's also seeking to ban LaPierre and Phillips and the NRA General Counsel John Fraser from serving in leadership positions at any charitable organization that conduct business in New York. A judge will decide those issues during the next phase of the state Supreme Court trial. James sued the NRA and its executives back in 2020 under her authority to investigate not-for-profits registered in the state. The organization, founded 150 years ago in New York City to promote rifle skills, but in recent decades, it has grown into a political juggernaut, influencing federal laws and presidential elections as it used its muscle to support the arms industry by blocking virtually any and or by blocking virtually any or all legislation meant to promote gun safety and slow our nation's horrific gun violence epidemic. Tish James originally sought to have the entire organization dissolved, but a Manhattan judge ruled in 2022 that the allegation did not warrant the so-called corporate death penalty in the state. So, with its 30-year leader now gone and the institution itself in tatters and bankruptcy, what happens next for the NRA? Does it still command the power that it once did? Will other, perhaps even farther right institutions step in to fill the breach? I got a lot of questions on all of that and more today, even as a recent oral argument at the U.S. Supreme Court suggests the gun lobby in America may be as powerful as ever, given the case which seeks to overturn a federal agency rule, a Trump-era rule that bans devices known as bump stocks that transform semi-automatic rifles into fully automatic machine guns. It is all, of course, of a piece with the high court's long, willful, corrupt misinterpretation of the Constitution's Second Amendment. Here to help us make sense of some of those questions is Kelly Sampson of the actually nonpartisan and nonprofit Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, where she is the director of racial justice and an expert on the connection between racial justice and gun violence. Kelly Sampson, thank you for joining us today on the broadcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about these important issues.
Yeah, there's a lot of them here. First, before we dig into some details on just not just what's happening to the NRA from here, but where the gun safety movement in America itself goes, AP reports that despite its recent woes, the NRA remains a political force. Republican presidential hopefuls flocked to its annual convention last year. Donald Trump spoke at an NRA a meeting just last month, his eighth speech to the group. The case in New York was obviously a huge win for Letitia James, but has or will any of this actually weaken the gun lobby's sort of, you know, decades-long ironclad grip on the Republican Party and the subsequent blockade of common-sense gun safety laws at both the state and federal level, Kelly?
I think that's a very astute question because Wayne LaPierre obviously is indicative of a particular type of corruption, taking advantage of people and basically grifting. Mm-hmm. He's not concerned with people's safety. He's concerned with enriching himself. And so this is a win in terms of accountability for that. But we also know there are organizations like the National Shooting Sports Foundation or NSSF, which is the gun industry's almost corporate wing. Mm-hmm. And they have particular influence and funds. There are other groups as well. And then because the NRA for so long under the leadership of Wayne LaPierre really used rhetoric to play on Americans' sincere desire to be safe and drum up constituents who genuinely they want to protect their families, but the NRA put out misinformation and disinformation. We are now working to undo some of those myths, such as the idea that having a gun automatically makes you safer. And so regardless of what happens with the NRA, we still have to deal with the rhetoric, the false information, mm-hmm. and the fact that, yes, there are some politicians who feel beholden to what the NRA wants, even though we have poll after poll showing that there is bipartisan support for a variety of gun laws, and that bipartisan support crosses gun owners mm-hmm. and non-gun owners. And so we still have a lot of work to do to make sure that the politicians that are in power are actually listening to what their constituents want and not what the NRA says their constituents want. And often those are very different.
Whether it's the NRA or the NSSF, which you mentioned, I want to get into them in a moment because there was an interesting new report on them. It's the first I had actually heard of them, but we'll get to them in a moment because when it comes to LaPierre and his leadership at the NRA, like I said, he's been there 30 years. Is there any reason to expect, Kelly, that we'll see different behavior or any different type of advocacy from the group, even with LaPierre and other top officials finally forced out of the organization? Or do you expect to see the same story from the group that we've seen for so many years?
Well, I wish I had a crystal ball. So my confidence in what I'm about to say, I would put it at about 50.
Okay.
I expect that the inward financial misbehavior uh-huh. may change, but I don't think that the misinformation and sort of entrenched opposition to common sense, very popular gun laws will change because the group has such a vested interest in furthering itself mm-hmm. And making sure that it continues its own existence. And unfortunately, facts and research are not on the NRA's side in terms of the way that they talk about guns. As mm-hmm. you mentioned, they started out about marksmanship, mm-hmm. Hunting. Those are not things that you need an AR-15 for example.
Right.
And so if they were truly going to follow what they say they're about, they would have to pivot. And I think they've gotten to the point where if they do that, that's like an existential threat to what they claim to be, mm-hmm. Because they've really gone really far from marksmanship. And now they've gone into sort of an anti-government, this is America's first freedom, sort of way off the deep end.
Yeah.
And I think that can't actually confront reality. So they have kind of no choice but to double down on it.
And I have this sense that no matter what happens to them in New York, and given the Trump trials out there as well, the Republicans and the right have just, gone to war with her in one sense. So they may just sort of ignore whatever happened to the NRA in New York. And, their lobbyists will still have the same type of open door invitation from lawmakers that they enjoyed, for decades at this point. Do we have any sense of that? Is the NRA still enjoying those open door invitations at the U.S. Capitol?
I don't know for certain what goes on behind closed doors, mm-hmm. but I can say the proof is in the pudding because what we know, for example, universal background checks. Mm-hmm. Those are among some of the most popular legislation, period, of any issue. Mm-hmm. Over 90% of Americans support them, and that crosses all sorts mm-hmm. of demographics, age, where you live, rural or urban, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a really popular piece of legislation, and I've seen that firsthand. It's not just based on polls. I've done work in states where I've heard from people that they say, I'm a gun owner, and about as conservative as you can be, and I think we should have these. And yet we don't have them.
Right.
They're stymied by politicians. So there has to be something going on there to cause politicians to disconnect from what their constituents want and form a very popular piece of legislation. So Occam's razor, it seems like there has to be some sort of influence, could be the NRA, probably the NSSF as well,
yep.
To make politicians intentionally depart from a really popular very effective, life-saving piece of legislation that a lot of Americans want. And I think that that's something really key that you mentioned about the NRA in this case, is that it was presented both as sort of almost a perpetuator and a victim, because it is a nonprofit. And there are a lot of Americans who, you know, they put their faith in this organization, but the organization doesn't have their best interests at heart, not just with their dollars, but also with their safety and with their desire to protect their families. And they're not really giving them complete information, and they are not really giving them an opportunity to really have a full picture of the ways that gun laws and Second Amendment can coexist.
Not giving them the full information is a very nice way to put it, Kelly Sampson. And NBC reported, you mentioned these guys a couple of times, NBC reported that the National Shooting Sports Foundation, or NSSF, as you've referred to them, is now, quote, the top advocate for the gun industry in D.C., spending more than ever to influence the federal government, accusing President Biden of waging war on the Second Amendment. Oh, that sounds familiar. Resisting any effort to create universal background checks, arguing that attempts to crack down on untraceable ghost guns are not needed. This group as well, founded more than 60 years ago to promote hunting and recreational shooting, the NSSF has now grown into the country's leading firearms trade association. It spent more than $5.5 million on federal lobbying last year, more than in any other year in its history, and more than twice as much as the NRA, according to the federal record. So, you know, it sounds like they're just taking their place. What can you tell us about the NSSF? Are they different in any way from the NRA, or are they simply the new NRA, Kelly?
They're different in sort of their makeup and stated purpose. So the NRA purports to be sort of the voice for gun owners in America. Whether or not that's true, obviously dubious. Mm-hmm. Whereas the NSSF is really a trade organization for groups and companies that sell firearms or sell firearms related products. So that's a difference in terms of the types of the legislative slash advocacy wing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't necessarily see a big difference in substance in terms of position and posture towards certain gun laws, but that is kind of, I guess, the key distinction. Is one is more of like a trade organization for an industry, and one is supposedly more of a grassroots.
Right. So, supposedly also doing a lot of work there, because the NRA really has been for years now, it seems, you know, representing those trade groups, those gun dealers, the arms industry itself, more than any of these, you know, good folks who otherwise send $20 a year or whatever it is to you know, be members in good standing with this, with the NRA, thinking it's a, you know, a longstanding good group. But yeah, it seems like there's always someone else ready to step into the breach to bastardize the Second Amendment to, you know, prevent gun safety laws. Late last month, Kelly Sampson, the right-wing 6-3 U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on the Yes, Trump-era ban by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives on so-called bump stocks that turn semi-automatic weapons into fully automatic machine guns. The ban was put in place after what was the deadliest mass shooting, at least in modern U.S. history, when a gunman in Las Vegas fired more than 1,000 rounds into a country music festival crowd in 11 minutes, killing 60, injuring hundreds. The Biden administration supported the Trump administration's ban on those devices. They argue that they are exactly what lawmakers were trying to ban when they enacted anti-machine gun laws back in the 1930s, when they were targeting, you know, gangster violence by gangsters like Al Capone. I know it's always dangerous to read tea leaves at oral arguments at this court in particular, but can we expect this corrupted court to block even even this attempt, supported by the Trump administration, for crying out loud, to at least lessen our American gun violence nightmares?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, reading the tea leaves is always difficult. But after hearing the oral arguments, we do have some reason to hope that the court will come down on the side of common sense and understanding that when Congress went to ban machine guns, that what they were getting at was the rate of fire and the capacity to have a whole host of rounds with one pull. And we think that bump stocks effectively do the same thing and they fit the same purpose. So again, reading tea leaves, always tricky. They could come down anyway, but we were optimistic at least.
We have to find optimism somewhere. The high court is also this term weighing another case that was heard back, I think, in November, challenging a federal law meant to keep guns away from people under domestic violence restraining orders. Again, seems like common sense. And I know you got no crystal ball. I keep asking you to read one. But will that federal law be allowed to stay in place under this court, as far as you could tell?
As far as we can tell, again, we certainly hope so. We think that that law in particular, unlike a lot of other ones, it's so egregious because of the well-established link between domestic and intimate partner violence and gun violence, that the sort of stereotypes around which justices are for or against gun laws doesn't always hold when it comes to domestic and intimate partner violence cases. And also there's really, even under Bruin, we think that there's reason to believe that the ban on individuals under a domestic violence restraining order accords with history and tradition, because it's really getting at dangerousness and risk. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you can find in any gun law in any time. So we certainly hope that the court will use the opportunity to clarify that when they say history and tradition, it's not just, can you find a historical twin, which is what Justice Thomas said in Bruin, but also, is it a close enough analog? And we think that when you look at it at that level of generality, that the federal ban on individuals under domestic violence restraining orders is sufficiently analogous to laws preventing dangerous people from getting firearms.
You know, I got to tell you, in one sense, even discussing these issues, Kelly, it feels so silly in one sense.
Yep. I
mean,
I agree.
You know, are machine guns allowed? Can we take guns away from people who have, you know, violent restraining orders against them? I mean, it's so much of this is low hanging fruit, even though, you know, universal background checks seems like the lowest hanging fruit possible. The NRA has long blocked that. Now, the Biden administration was able to pass the first gun safety law of any kind in some 30 years. That's the 2022 Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. But frankly, all of that seems like just low-hanging fruit. Is there, in truth, anything that this administration has done or can do to effectively curb our gun epidemic? Or is it really just a matter of sort of nibbling at this low-hanging fruit as we watch this shameful, ongoing tragedy unfold in America?
That's a great question. And I want to agree with you at the kind of ridiculousness when we step back. Mm-hmm. But hopefully what I'll tell you can offer a little bit of, you know, hope, because we need it.
Thank you.
So
yes.
One of the best things that the Biden administration has done, let me step back. So at Brady, one of the things that we think a lot about is the way that gun violence is a multifaceted issue. Mm-hmm. And you have to deal with the guns themselves, obviously. That is a huge part, because we look at other countries that don't have the loose laws that we do, and we see that they have basically no gun violence. Mm-hmm. So we have to deal with the guns. But then we also have to deal with the culture and some of the more behavioral change and public health aspects of gun violence. For example, 60% or more than 60% of gun deaths in the country are suicides. So how do we deal with that? Also, how do we deal with the ways that in communities that are dealing with sort of cycles of gun violence, mm-hmm. that trauma begets trauma, which can also lead to more gun violence. And so those are the sorts of issues that you don't necessarily need a gun law to pass. And so what the Biden-Harris administration has done is they set up the first White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which really is using the power of the executive to have a whole of government approach and make sure that every single agency is convening to make sure that we're dealing with, okay, how do we, knowing that a lot of people have guns and a lot of people with guns may take their own lives with those guns, how do we work on safe storage? How do we make sure that we're dealing to make sure that communities that are suffering the most have the resources that they need for evidence-based community violence intervention programs and the like? And that office does a lot of that work. And it's not to say that we don't need every tool in the box.
Right.
But it's definitely something that is having a tangible impact, especially around community groups that have had really like evidence-based results on the community violence intervention, for example, but they need resources. And that office is doing a lot to work with those programs. We do need Congress to act to kind of supplement that, but I do think from what I can see, the administration is using all the tools that it has to do what it can do, and then the state and local government as well are moving a lot of gun laws too.
But that focus on, and I know you focus in your work at the Brady Center and in your award-winning podcast Red, Blue, and Brady on the connection between racial justice and gun violence and the underlying causes of the American firearm epidemic. Ironically, I should note, the NRA, they love to focus on inner city gun violence to scare Americans with that. But in truth, they go on to block efforts that would help, you know, decrease that as well. Kelly Sampson, I got to get out, but give me a quick idea of the kind of issues that you explore in your work at Brady and specifically on your podcast, Red, Blue, and Brady.
Thanks for that. Yeah, so again, gun violence is so complex because you could be talking about domestic violence or police violence or suicide or a mass shooting or a shooting that takes place on a neighborhood street. And so what all these have in common, obviously, is our gun laws are so lax, right? So that's one part of it. But then within that, we also have to think about behavioral change and the like. And so when it comes to gun violence and race, we are dealing with a country that on one hand criminalizes and stereotypes people of color, especially Black and brown people. And so there's a tension whenever we're talking about gun laws with our impulse to overcriminalize. And so a lot of what we work on is when we're looking at gun laws, how can we make sure that they both prevent gun violence as designed without increasing disparate impact on communities that are most vulnerable to that, because ultimately that does nothing but destabilize the community, which can lead to gun violence. So we do a lot of that work, and then also working alongside groups that are on the ground to complement and uplift their work. And then on the podcast, we really try to have conversations that go beyond sort of a quick soundbite, like you're doing here. So we talk to all sorts of people. We talk to researchers and academics. We talk to community advocates, pastors, teens who are activists, artists. We're really trying to, and gun owners, I should mention that. We've had many episodes with gun owners on. And what we're really trying to do there is get beyond sort of the stereotype, which is often that this issue is non-gun owners against gun owners, suburban people against urban people, you know, Democrats versus Republicans, when it's really not, because everybody wants to be safe. It's just how we're thinking about that. And so the podcast is really us trying to explore all these different angles of gun violence and really have meaningful conversations that get at, like, what can we do about this problem that we all feel in different ways. So, yeah.
Yes, yes. Yes, please. Keep that conversation going. We need it. Kelly Sampson is the co-host of the award-winning podcast Red, Blue, and Brady. She is the director of racial justice and an expert on the connection between racial justice and gun violence at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization and the nation's oldest gun violence prevention organization. You can follow them on the Twitters at Brady Center, and you can check their website for the podcast and more at BradyUnited.org. Kelly Sampson, really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you very much for the work that you and the center are doing.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. You know, as I'm sitting here speaking with Kelly, I'm thinking to myself, how nice that we're having a conversation about guns and gun violence on a day where there hasn't just been a mass shooting moments before that has forced us to have this conversation.
That's a really harrowing observation to make. I mean, I'm glad that there isn't one. I do also want to point out that the Brady Center does have local grassroots chapters across the country that are working at the state and local level and, of course, helping to get voters to get out and vote on gun safety reform. And I think it's really vital because the NRA, even if the NRA itself as an organization disappears or is, you know, severely hobbled, there are other organizations like the ones she's covered that are still going forward to ensure that they can buy elections and continue to bring about mass death.
Look, as much as the firearm industry now makes in profit on death, they are not going to be easily done away with, even if you do away with the NRA.
Yep.
And so they'll just be replaced by the next group of ghouls who wish to make money off this sort of thing.
Yes.
So the fight continues. The good fight continues. Got to get out. My thanks to Desi Doyen, our producer, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, you can download all of them for free, going back forever at bradblog.com. A service made possible by folks like you who, instead of giving your money to the NRA, stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves and fight those liars and cretins and criminals over at the NRA and whatever other group pops up. You can drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, you'll find me at TheBradBlog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day Transport Workers Union Local 260 negotiated its first contract with the Pioneer Bus Company in Houston, Texas. It came after months of fighting to build an integrated union there. The local had learned the previous year that Pioneer was organized by an independent union that maintained Jim Crow bargaining units. The drivers, dispatchers, and shop employees union maintained separate and unequal bargaining units, one for white workers and one for black workers. They also had separate seniority lists, representation, and levels of promotion. The Transport Workers Union filed a petition with the National Labor Relations Board against the drivers' union. They demanded an election. The existing union argued that collective bargaining agreements already existed, which precluded any possibility of holding a new election for representation. The TWU pushed back. They contended that the contract bar rule could not apply to discriminatory agreements that divided workers along racial lines. The TWU also argued that it would be unconstitutional for the board to uphold Jim Crow contracts. The board agreed with the TWU and threatened to decertify the drivers' union on the basis of racial discrimination. They concluded that where the bargaining representative of employees in an appropriate union executes separate contracts or even a single legal contract discriminating between Negro and white employees on racial lines, the board will not deem such contracts as a bar to an election. In the days before the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the board drew from Brown versus Board of Education to issue its ruling in December of 1962. The TWU won the election by a 3-1 margin and championed the end of Jim Crow at Pioneer.